Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our contributing editor, Leila Latif.
Hello.
This week, we'll also be hearing from Robot Dreams director, Pablo Berger. We're going to have reviews of raunchy road movie Driveway Dolls, Hirokazu Koreeda's mystery drama Monster, Australian coming-of-age story The New Boy, and a romance, Benel and Adama. But first, the biggest event in the movie calendar has just taken place. Leila, I know you're an avid awards follower, so let's talk about this year's Oscars. I mean, I suppose the main thing is it seemed like there weren't any big surprises really in terms of winners, were there?
Yeah, I kind of knew, I suspected that Oppenheimer was going to storm it, but they did even better than I thought they would. I suspected Nolan might not get director, but I was really pleased that he did. Very well deserved. I think nobody really saw Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon taking absolutely nothing.
No.
Coming. I thought they'd kind of give him something. But yeah, I suppose the only surprise really was Emma Stone over Lily Gladstone. I know that was kind of a bit in close contention, but I was really convinced Lily was going to get it.
Because I saw some people doing some predictions before, and as everyone does, obviously, but it felt like so many of them were locked, really. But that was the one that was, it was felt 50-50 between those two right at the end, because it felt like Lily Gladstone was just completely nailed on early doors, didn't it? And then I suppose there's been a couple of late wins for Emma Stone, which maybe seemed like was the kind of tide turning a bit there. I must admit, I love both the performances, to be honest. Like you say, it's a bit of a shame that Killers of the Flower Moon went completely empty handed. And again, maybe it peaked too early with its Cannes premiere, but it seemed like just everyone loved it. And it seemed like it was the early one to beat in terms of, like, you know, awards buzz starting earlier and earlier these days.
But I wonder whether there's something about the format that made a bit of a difference, because Killers of the Flower Moon was Apple Plus, I believe. And I think Oppenheimer did just have this like great will of like, it got people back into the cinemas. It kind of, you know, a bit like, you know, people were saying that how, you know, Top Gun Maverick saved cinema last year, like with Oppenheimer and Barbie to a certain extent. But like Oppenheimer, it just seemed like such a wonderful celebration of what I guess all of those like strikers this year were kind of campaigning for, because it's like a director with like a single vision. It's like not patronizing to the audience. It's 3.5 hours long. It's a biopic. It's like really ambitious. So I can totally see why that was the thing that they wanted to put their weight behind. But I was kind of surprised with Emma Stone and Poor Things, because I remember seeing it at Venice and thinking like, oh my God, I absolutely love this movie. She's fantastic in it. No way this is going to win anything. It's too weird. But yeah, Yorgos Lanthimos, apparently this is now like quite a solid way to get an Oscar, because like, yeah, he did it for Olivia Colman all those years ago as well.
He's certainly a safe bet for actors if they want to go and work with him.
She is amazing though, Emma Stone, isn't she? It does seem a bit of a shame, but there's a bit of a backlash, I think, because, you know, best actress is probably like diversity wise the worst category out there. I think it's been like, what, 78 years Emma Stone's got two, all women of color collectively have two, Frances McDormand has three. Shame. I hope that doesn't take away from her, because she was absolutely incredible.
Yeah. And I, like I say, I genuinely love that performance. And I think, like, yeah, can't kind of, you know, complain about her winning in that sense at all. And this is obviously one of those things that it's not her fault at all, but you almost just feel a bit bad because she's already got one. It just seems a bit unfair, doesn't it? When you've already got one and then you kind of win it again, it just seems a bit unfair. But, you know,
She seemed very shocked, didn't she? But I mean, because you kind of want to see someone like having like the greatest moment of their life when they do their speech. And even I remember when Frances McDormand won her third, she seemed like not that bothered. And Emma Stone seemed very excited. But yeah, it's not as exciting to see someone get their second one.
And anyone who knows me knows I'm a massive Nolan fan. So obviously I was very pleased with that outcome. And I was kind of glad to see him get it for a great film, rather than sort of, you know, being one of these people who kind of gets it years and years later as effectively, you know, where it feels like an honorary, like, you know, well, you've paid your dues, you deserve one now. So it was kind of nice to see him getting one when he's in his prime. But what did you think about the actual ceremony this year? Because again, it seemed to overall go down well. The viewing figures seem to be up in the US. So How did you find the ceremony itself?
Yeah, I don't think Jimmy Kimmel is like the most exciting host, but he did a pretty good job, to be fair to him. I do kind of miss the Billy Crystal era. I like them when they do like a big song and dance. I was actually just this morning rewatching Hugh Jackman's
Oh,
intro, which I
yeah.
think is like one of the best of all
It's so
time.
good, isn't it? Yeah.
We did get that with Ryan Gosling,
Yeah,
and that Ken performance was amazing.
I thought they did pretty well this year, yeah, because the kind of star power, I mean, they really leaned into that in terms of the presenters and everything. The yeah, Jimmy Kimmel, similarly to you, I think he's like a safe pair of hands. I just loved that. I'm just Ken, like that was, I mean, that's got to be the best Oscars performance in like absolute years, and that just feels like one that, a bit like Hugh Jackman's thing, people are just going to be rewatching that on YouTube for decades to come. I think it was just like one of those things where just more joyful things just kept popping up throughout it, basically. And I love that song as well. So I just, yeah, that was a great moment. I thought there was some, yeah, some fun presenting. And while it was a bit cheesy, I actually quite liked the actor presenting, where they had the former winners up, each doing a bit of a spiel about each of the nominees.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it was sweet. They seemed like I think they all seemed quite moved by hearing that stuff about themselves. But my favorite was Nick Cage introducing Paul Giamatti. That was so funny. He just kind of did it in the way that only Paul Giamatti could. But yeah, also just really happy to see Jonathan Glazer win because I was reviewing the new Sexy Beast TV show a few, well, maybe a month or two ago, and I did go back over his films. He only makes one about
I
every
know.
like what 8 years or something, but like Sexy Beast is so good, as is Under the Skin, even though that's got a very upsetting scene with a baby, and I loved Zone of Interest, so that was lovely.
He just doesn't miss, does he? Like, in a way, it's a shame he just doesn't knock them out more regularly. But I mean, when they're just guaranteed sort of bangers after you've waited those 8 or 10 years, it's like you can't really complain too much, can you?
Hopefully we'll be sat here in like I don't know, 2033 enjoying the next one.
The next. So that was this year's Oscars. Next week sees the release of Spanish-French animation Robot Dreams, which was actually nominated for Best Animated Feature at this year's Oscars. And it's the dialogue-free story of a dog and his robot friend. Contributing editor James Mottram recently caught up with the film's director, Pablo Berger, and this is their conversation.
So let's start by asking, how did you discover Sara's book, first of all, and what were your initial reactions when you read it?
I discovered the book in 2010 just because I collect graphic novels, dialogue free, and illustration books without dialogue. And I read that it had been a big hit in the United States. So I ordered it online because it had never been published in Spain. So my first reaction was, wow, this is cool. This is fun. This is surreal. This is emotional, and it became one of my favorite graphic novels. But at that moment, I didn't think about making a film. I just put it on the shelf of my collection of wordless graphic novels. I made two films. I made Blancanieves and Abracadabra. And in 2018, when I started thinking about my fourth film, I was just having a coffee, you know, procrastinating, and just took out the book, which is here. I went through the books. I felt the same that when I read it for the first time, but this time it was more intense. So when I got to the end of the book, I was deeply moved. When I'm talking about deeply moved, I was in tears, and I'm not exaggerating. And I thought, why didn't it happen before? Because the first time I read it, those 8 years, I lost a lot of dear people for me. So I made a lot of substitutions reading the book, and I said, wow, if I felt this emotion be the end, I'm sure there's a lot of people, if we make a film, they're going to feel the same that I did when I read the book. And that's the only reason I made this film. Basically, I love the story, and I want to share the story with the film audience.
You've not worked in animation before, so how challenging was that to take on a completely different form, let's say, to what you're used to working with? I mean, how much trepidation did you have going into this project?
It was a lot of trepidation. I was scared, but I was not blocked. It was just a challenge. You know, I, as a director, all my films are very different between them. I like to get out of my comfort zone. I like the challenges. The funny thing is that when I started the production, what I realized is that there were many more things in common than differences. It was just a question of doing substitutions. For example, in a live action film, I have a deep director of photography, art director, hair, makeup, a big crew on the set. But when you work in animation, basically you have one big department that is called the art department. And instead of being on the set, you're in the studio. But the way I collaborate and communicate with them, it was exactly the same. There was no difference, actually. The biggest difference, it would be that in live action, you work with actors and director has a very close relation with actors. And here I had to substitute for animators. And actually, that's where I thought I could bring something to the animation world, my experience with working with actors. But I needed some kind of assistance to work with animators. And that's the director of animation, Benoit Ferramont, that he had worked in The Triplets of Bilbil as a director of animation and in The Book of Kells with Tom Moore. So he was a great help to translate my indications, because I really gave indications about emotions, about truth, about less is more, don't overact. And basically, I would tell them, trust the story. You really have to trust the story. Don't try to save the scene. The story is working, the characters are working, so give me less. And my attention to the eyes, because for me, when I work with actors, I just look straight to the eyes. And if I feel true emotion, I know I got the take. But with animation, it was the same. You know, I was really looking at the eyes of the characters, trying to get truthful acting in the drawings.
And how difficult is it to create a film, well, basically a silent movie with no dialogue? I mean, that's extremely difficult. Obviously, that's how movies began, but you're used to working with dialogue with actors. So how difficult was that to kind of think into that mindset of a silent movie?
I already had made a wordless feature film called Blancanieves like 10 years ago. And it had been such an amazing and learning experience for me as a director that I was waiting to find the right project to do something similar, but very different at the same time. I didn't want to repeat myself, but I really wanted to continue exploring writing with images. Like, as you said, you know, that's what makes film a unique art form. You know, my favorite period in the history of cinema is the 20s. You know, Abel Gance, Murnau, Dreyer, Victor Hostrom, there's so many. I mean, Anthony Asquith made some great films, like Hitchcock, of course. So I wanted to continue in that direction. But the fact that it's an animation, it gave me the possibility to do something new. Robot Dreams is not a silent film. It's a film that the characters don't talk. But there's a very complex sound design. So for me, more than a challenge, it was to continue exploring this element. And somehow it's true. I feel in a way with a second feature that is without dialogue, I feel a little bit like a cinematographic terrorist. Denis Villeneuve made a very big statement that it was very viral. He said, I hate dialogue. I'm not going to say I hate dialogue, but I really think that the cake is visual storytelling and the whipped cream is the dialogue.
One of the most beautiful things in the film is the way you create the cityscape, the sort of urban landscape, you know, Manhattan and so forth. It's like a Manhattan of your dreams, basically. But how did you envisage that, taking it from the page of the book, you know, into the film?
In the book, it doesn't appear New York. It's just a non-identified city. But when I made the decision of making this film, it was key when I realized the characters are going to be Robot, Dog, and New York City for a very simple reason. I lived in New York for 10 years, and I wanted to make a love letter to New York, an ode to New York. So to do that, I had a great art director, José Luis Ágreda, that he had done an amazing film a few years before called Buñuel in the Turtles Labyrinth, I think is the title in English. But I also had the assistance of my closest collaborator since my first film, Yuko Harami, which she was location scouting. And she lived in New York 10 years as well. So we wanted to make a period film, a film that took place in the mid-80s. And every detail had to be precise. We wanted that the audience when they buy a ticket and see it in a cinema and they sit on the seat, they travel in time to a New York that has vanished. And for us, that was very, very important.
And what was Sarah's reaction when you showed her the film? I mean, how nervous were you to present this movie to the author of the book?
Honestly, I was very nervous. I will give you a flashback when I met her. I met her in 2018 in New York. She was living there. She's a New Yorker herself, although she lives in Chicago at this moment. She had seen my film Blancanieves. So I told her, I want to make Robot Dreams into a hand-drawn animation film. And she was thrilled. And she immediately said, yes, of course you had all the legal and all the agents and all these things. But her immediate reaction was yes. And she told me, I made the graphic novel, you make the film. And what I'm trying to say, she gave me carte blanche. She was not involved in the script. She was not involved in any creative decision in the making of the film. Definitely she was informed. She came to visit us to the studio. And many times I repeated to her, Sarah, I love the subtext, the theme, the soul of your film, of your book so much. I'm going to protect it, even if it's going to be very different from your book. And so I was very nervous when she came to Toronto, the Toronto Film Festival, and she saw the film. And honestly, we were sitting together at the Toronto Film Festival. And while she was watching at the screen, I was watching at her. I didn't even watch at the screen. I was just looking at her reaction to every single moment. And I must tell you, she went through all the possible, like a roller coaster of emotions. I saw her in her face. And when the film finished, we just hugged. We both in tears. And she was, you made something that is the same and at the same time so different. So yeah, she's thrilled. She was at the Oscar nights with me at the ceremony. So she's been through the whole process.
Well, I was going to ask you about the Oscar night. Well, congratulations, first of all, for your nomination. I think you should have won, but there you go. That's my opinion.
Thank
how
you,
was the whole experience of being nominated and then going to the ceremony? What was that like?
Well, it was amazing. You know, I don't know if you've seen, James, there's like a video that with our reaction, you know, you should tell Corson to show it to you. It became viral in Spain because our reaction, you can see how we felt. The last month, I've been back and forth to LA and to New York. So it's been like really the campaign. You really have to do a campaign. So we had to do a lot of screenings, meet the people, do a lot of interviews. Basically, it's been so exciting, so much fun, especially things like having a screening in Film Forum in New York with a Q&A and meeting how the New Yorkers would react to Robot Dreams. So that was the film. So that was super exciting. And I also had the chance to meet all the other nominees, directors from Nimona, from Spider-Man, from Elemental. So we made like a really like a gang, like a rat pack of animation directors. So it's been like fantastic. And then the ceremony, I must tell you, it's so much fun. It works like everything is so well, such a great timing. And we had like probably almost like 60 people of Robot Dreams came to LA to celebrate with us. So it's been amazing. I have, and also what has been great is that the nomination has made the film global. And we know that more people are going to see the film. And for a director, of course, we didn't win the Oscar. But for us, it's just, for me, the prize is that more people are going to see the film. And we know that that's happening because of the nomination.
Did you sort of meet any, you know, actors that were big fans of the movie? Anyone that came up and said how much they loved it to you?
My moment was when I met Steven Spielberg. You know, there was a moment that I met Steven. We were on the line for the photo call for the luncheon nominees. And I had, this is my moment, you know. So I have to tell you that I became a director. The first time I was aware there was a director is Jaws. I saw it as a kid with my parents. So I have to express my admiration. He had not seen Robot Dreams. I had to make promotion. You know, I did campaign. I didn't have a chance to see him again later, so I don't know if he had seen it. But what I have met is a lot of directors that I had seen. You know, that's the thing. Like, for example, Robot Dreams has been supported so strongly by the animation world in the United States. The producers of Spider-Man and the directors of the first, Phil Lord and Chris, they just said, We love it. The director of Elemental, Peter Sean, love it. So what I felt is a lot of love from the community, you know, and I think the first one to really support the film was Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro saw the film, has put so many tweets praising the film. So I feel the animation world in the United States has really supported the film. And that's the reason why we were nominated.
Final question. Can you see yourself going back to animation, having been through the process once, or would you rather make a live action movie next?
Well, what I discover is just I can move from one media to another. You know, I love live action. I love to work with actors and with the camera, but I also enjoyed so much to work in animation. So like other directors like Guillermo del Toro that is doing Frankenstein now, or Wes Anderson, I feel comfortable. And in a way, what I discover is that it opened my mind because I'm a writer, director, so I'm going to write different stories. I will write in a different way if you're doing animation and if you're doing live action. So it opened my window of stories that I can tell. So that's very exciting for me.
So that's Robot Dreams, which opens next week on Friday, the 22nd of March, and we'll review that next week. So on to new releases now. And first up, Ethan Coen is going it alone with this.
I've had it with love. I don't believe it's relevant to the 21st century lesbian.
You're not wearing that.
I just came from work.
I came from Toledo. I don't dress like it.
I'm not here to peddle my wares.
I'm leaving town.
I am too. That was my plan. Where are you going?
Tallahassee, Florida. I've been unhappy.
That's why we take this trip together, honey babe.
We get our act together, together.
So this is Driveway Dolls, which is the first feature that Ethan Coen has directed without brother Joel. He's previously made a documentary on his own. But it's very much a collaboration between Ethan and his wife, Trisha Cook, who co-wrote the screenplay, co-produced the film and edited it as well. This is an old script that Coen and Cook dusted off from about 20 years ago, and it tells the story of two friends who are lesbians, but they're really sort of chalk and cheese opposites. Jamie, played by Margaret Qualley, is the sort of uninhibited free spirit, whereas Marion, played by Geraldine Viswanathan, is much more buttoned up. They're like a real odd couple friendship. And the motive for this film is a trip to Florida that Marion's taking that Jamie decides to tag along with. And they use this car rental service where they're effectively hooked up with a car that needs to go to the same place as them in a sort of quid pro quo arrangement. But they end up accidentally being given the wrong car, which has a mysterious package in the trunk. And it means that some unsavory types led by Coleman Domingo's chief are in pursuit of them. Feels like a throwback, probably because it's based on an old script. But what did you actually think of this film, Layla?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Coen brothers. Ethan Coen, I mean, I can't tell them apart. I just know that one of them is married to Trisha Cook and one of them is married to Frances McDormand. But so this is the one that's not married to Frances McDormand. This is the Trisha Cook one. Yeah, a real throwback. I mean, it's all centered around a MacGuffin with the suitcase. It's very, very short. It's like less than 90 minutes, I think. And it's just sort of an excuse for us to go on the road with these kind of two very quirky comedic performances from Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan, who are both absolutely delightful. I've really liked both of them in quite a few things, mostly TV stuff. Like, I thought Margaret Qualley was incredible in Maid, and Geraldine Viswanathan has been so funny in Miracle Workers with Steve Buscemi and Daniel Radcliffe. So I was really excited to see it. I think it's quite disposable, like as a project from Ethan Coen goes. It is very funny. It is raunchy and like silly in a lot of very good ways. And Coleman Domingo is just so good as a sort of almost like mustache twirling villain. I actually found myself, even though it was quite short, feeling like it was a bit bloated somehow. Not that much happens, and it's sort of a bit fait accompli. But sadly, like, my favorite scene, I think, was the one right at the beginning where you get Pedro Pascal being dispatched of in a ridiculous fashion.
I suppose that's the kind of Coen effect. But yeah, there are some like little fun cameos throughout this with kind of including Pedro, and Matt Damon's also got like a small but key role as well. And I must admit, I felt similarly to you overall, but maybe I was slightly more underwhelmed than you seemed, in that I was really up for it. Similarly, really like Margaret and Geraldine, you know, I like the idea of just this kind of fun, silly, like throwaway kind of film. It's really, really brisk, but I found it hard to shake this feeling of being underwhelmed by it. Like, I normally do really like Margaret Qualley, but I struggled with her accent here because she's just doing a really, really kind of over the top sort of southern sort of non-specific accent, which I just found kind of a bit grating. And it was one of those films that there were certain moments which, again, I won't spoil, and I won't spoil what's hidden in the trunk, for example, because it's sort of fun to see that. But when I kind of thought about it afterwards, I thought, like, that seems really funny on paper. Like, that's the sort of thing I would laugh at, some of the stuff that Matt Damon's involved in. I was almost just like, you know, when you just watch a film and you just kind of like smile at it, you just never really are kind of, you know, really belly laughing. That was kind of how I felt. And yeah, then I felt like once we did reach in, because I didn't realize how short it was when I watched it, but just almost felt like it ended with a bit of a shrug almost when I got to the end. But it was, again, it was a shame, because it was the kind of thing I was willing myself to like a bit more as it was going on. But just felt a bit underwhelmed, really.
Yeah, some of the sort of sex jokes are almost like bordering on like Farrelly Brothers level, which was a bit kind of like surprising for like people of this magnitude to be making. And I know what you mean. I feel like we needed like a couple more like plot twists. It almost needed to become like a bit like farcical and stuff, but it's not one of his finest.
And if you know you've got these cameos as well, maybe you're just expecting something a bit more. But again, those are just quite a throwaway as well, really, aren't they?
Yeah, true. I mean, I did very much enjoy it. Beanie Feldstein in it. She's always a delight. But a lot of the sort of gags are quite repetitive. And there's like a point at which I think you do become a bit like numb to like, oh my goodness, lesbian sex. How crazy. still, you know, a nice time at the movies. And I always kind of admire like the confidence of bringing something in at less than 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Classic Jonathan Glazer does that.
I always like the kind of quote unquote serious filmmakers just kind of cutting loose and making something a bit silly, a bit frivolous. And there is something enjoyable about that. Like, not everything has to be like a big heavyweight dramatic investment. Sometimes you just want a bit of throwaway fun, don't you? And does deliver in that sense. But I suppose I just couldn't help wishing I actually just found it a bit funnier, I suppose.
Be interesting to see what he does next. Because Joel's made a film without Ethan, hasn't he?
Macbeth, The Tragedy of Macbeth, yeah.
God, that's funny, though. When you go their separate ways, that one of them did Macbeth and the other one did Drive Away Dolls. It does feel like more of a sofa movie than a going to the cinema movie. But yeah, maybe it would have been given a boost if I hadn't left the house. But still, perfectly nice time.
So that is Drive Away Dolls, which is in cinemas from Friday. Next up, we've got a mysterious drama from Hirokazu Koreeda. So this is Monster from acclaimed Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. It's sort of hard to say too much about this film without maybe spoiling it, but a story about childhood and sort of growing up in a lot of ways. And at the center of the story is a young boy called Minato, played by Soya Kurokawa. And at the beginning, he seems quite distressed. His mother's kind of noticing unusual behavior in him and kind of injuries. And he seems like he's having a tough time at school. And it particularly seems like he might be having a tough time with his teacher, who his mother actually kind of goes into the school and confronts. And we see this kind of, you know, these events play out. And then in a sort of almost Rashomon-like device, the film then jumps back and we see this time period and these events through another character's eyes. And then that will then happen again a third time too. So we see it sort of refracted through all these slightly different viewpoints. I kind of saw this knowing nothing really about it, but how did you find it, Leila? Did you like this film?
I was expecting a horror film, given the title. But yeah, no, I did really like it. I like the whole way where you kind of only really see the whole picture of it when you've seen the story for the third time, and it keeps kind of returning to this like burning building, and it was quite elegantly done and stuff. The only thing that I would say is that I found the third perspective, which is the one that kind of unlocks it all, so I understand why that went third, like the least interesting in a weird way, even though it all does kind of hang together and make sense. Like as the sort of mystery slowly gets solved, I've found myself a bit less and less engaged.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Are you a fan of Corrida's previous films? Like, is he a sort of a filmmaker you're familiar with?
Not terribly familiar, to be honest. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Rashomon. I think that was one of the first movies that actually got me into movies. And I love this kind of device that also they kind of did with The Last Duel, where you see things from different perspectives. I mean, not someone that I kind of know too much of his like backstory. You can kind of see that it's like a long gestating project of his, because like some of the ways in which you see things and then he reframes them in a very subtle way that completely reveals a different truth is really impressively done.
Yeah, subtle's like a good word, because I don't know his entire like back catalogue, but I've always enjoyed the films of his that I have seen, and yeah, like tend to find subtle being the word. Like Our Little Sister was actually the first time I saw one of his films. Again, I just remember that was one that really kind of crept up on me and sort of moved me in a way that I wasn't expecting, almost, you know, where a film kind of slowly gets its claws into you without you even kind of realizing until you get to the end. And I felt similarly about Broker as well, which came out a year or two ago over here. This one, I did like this one. I felt sort of similar to you in that, like, I wasn't sure if the device 100% worked, especially, you know, as you kind of get to the end. But there was something, again, I found since seeing it, it's really played on my mind a lot. Little moments have kind of stuck with me. I did find it touching. And like you said, there's just something fascinating about when you just see things from a slightly different perspective. And, you know, it seems like it's all one way in the opening version that we're seeing, and then things kind of get turned on their heads.
And normally kind of like kids' performances, I think particularly given like the subject matter, which I won't kind of unveil because you've got to watch all three timelines in order to actually figure out exactly what's going on. I think he does a really fantastic job, because you could kind of end up with it being a bit like melodramatic, but he manages to both kind of, I think, sell his kind of perspective quite well, but also be a bit sort of mercurial in all the other ones, so you don't really know what's going on.
Both the two main, like Soya Kurokawa playing Minato, who's arguably sort of the main character it kind of revolves around, but then it also kind of ties in with this kind of blossoming relationship, friendship he has with a classmate called Yori, who's played by Hinata Hiragi. I mean, I'm not actually 100% sure how old they even are, but they seem very young. And but I thought, again, they were very, very kind of subtle in their performances, very, very believable, very sort of touching at times. And they both have different troubles to deal with at home, different kind of father issues, I suppose, each of them have got. Like Minato's dad has died sometime previously, so that kind of hangs over him. And he lives with his mum. And Yori has sort of issues with his own dad as well. But I thought they were kind of subtly handled. And it's sort of one of those, again, an interesting film where I believe it's a 12A over here. There's nothing that's like that difficult on screen, but there's some implied stuff that's quite upsetting really in here, I think. Did you feel the same?
Yeah, I think it's always kind of, like particularly both of us being parents, like there is like that slight fear that I think it kind of taps into. The world is sort of filled with scary things for your kids, but also that you might just like really not know what's going on with them, because they do sort of, as they grow up, kind of go into their own little world. And that's why I kind of found her, the first act, from the perspective of the mother, probably the most interesting, because I think it like tapped into like a really big fear that I have. Like, what's going on with them? Will I ever understand?
And there's just always like the fear and horror of like bullying as well, isn't it? Again, for me at least anyway, like the older you get, the more scary bullying kind of seems. And you know, that, yeah, like exactly what's going on in school that you don't necessarily know about, and how different people react to it and all that kind of stuff. And yes, and I found something like moving and sort of touching about the way that the Yori character, he has some really tough times, but he just always seems to have like a chirpy little smile on. And I found something about that was almost kind of like breaking me at times, that he just seemed to have such a sort of upbeat demeanor despite kind of, you know, going through some sort of tough things at school and at home.
Yeah, he's a really lovely character. And also that kind of whole thing of like the bad faith teacher, because this is something my mum started working in education when I was like a teenager. My whole life she'd had that whole thing of like, don't be silly, your teachers don't dislike you and like they don't have favorites and they're not like interpreting everything that you do in the worst way possible. And then when she started that job, she was like, oh no, they have grudges, it turns out. like the whole thing of like the teacher that's just kind of just interpreting things in like the worst way possible. A lot of the time, got into some other traumas of mine.
And can I ask you as well, without going into any spoilers, but what did you make of the end of this one when we actually reached the true end? To me, that felt there was a massive ambiguity to it, that I felt like it could have been interpreted in two wildly different directions. But I wasn't sure if that was just me or if that was intentional or if other people felt that way about it.
Yeah, I kind of assumed that it was up to you to kind of decide, which makes sense given that it's, you know, a film that is like all of the characters in it like are not really picking up on entirely what's going on and don't have like very clear answers.
And all the characters have like kind of different sides to them as well, don't they, in some respect.
I do feel like I now have to kind of maybe do some correcting, get back into the filmography creator, because I think I've only seen Shoplifters actually, and I should have done more than that in order to be qualified for this job.
This has made me want to kind of mop up the couple that I haven't seen as well. I mean, it's just such a cliche to say this, but it is one of those films that once you've seen it, you do kind of want to go back and see it again once you have that information, you know, once you have the full sort of suite of information available to you. But if you fancy seeing that for the first time, that's Monster, and that's in cinemas from Friday. Next up, it's time for Kate Blanchett as a rebellious nun.
I am writing regarding the progress of the new boy you sent us. After a shaky start, he is learning to read and to write. He has a passion for Christ, and I feel that he may even follow in my footsteps.
This is The New Boy. Layla, can you introduce this one for us, please?
So this is a Australian film that is set in, I think it's like the 40s, and it's sort of, believe it's in some ways based on the real life experiences of the writer director Warwick Thornton. He was adopted, as is the new boy. He's an Aboriginal child who gets kind of taken into a orphanage, which is run in theory by a monk, but he's actually dead. And it turns out that like Kate Blanchett is doing some sort of light Weekend at Bernie's action and kind of pretending that he's alive so she can kind of keep the ruse going. He sort of over the film sort of develops some kind of special powers. They're quite subtle, some Jesus-y elements to it, like stigmata comes into play and stuff. And it's sort of, it's kind of up to you to decide whether or not this is sort of connected to Christianity, whether this is something very much that's kind of sort of born of like Aboriginal magic. It's all quite lyrical and for you to decide, but at the same time, there's some quite interesting ideas around, I think, like colonialism, which I guess any film set in Australia in the 1940s needs to tackle.
Did you actually enjoy it?
I kind of admired it more than I enjoyed it. I wonder whether a bit of it comes down to having not slept on Sunday night. but yeah, I was struggling a bit to kind of keep focused on it. I really did enjoy the soundtrack, I must say. It's Nick Cave and his longtime collaborator, Warren Ellis, and that was absolutely wonderful. But perhaps I think I was enjoying it so much that it was almost like lulling me off into a doze.
I'm in a sort of slightly similar position in the sense that I don't feel like I can truly comment on this film because I did see it. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and it was the first film I saw there on arrival on my first morning there. So I kind of arrived late the night before. That was my first film in the morning. So I wasn't in the greatest headspace to be kind of appreciating it. And everything you've said rings true to how I remember it. But again, maybe I was being unfair to it, or maybe it does just have that feeling to it then if we both felt that. But I also thought it looked kind of stunning as well in the way that often does when you're shooting the Australian sort of outback. And yeah, again, the score being great, like you say, this kind of lyrical quality, there's these kind of mystery elements and you're sort of not entirely sure what's going on. And again, maybe it was like in a tired haze, that just didn't kind of wasn't what I needed. I needed to be spoon-fed something at that point in the festival, probably, just as I was kind of getting my bearings. But yeah, it was one of those things that, yeah, like had these kind of haunting qualities, something sort of interesting about it. And again, that this weirdness of the sort of Weekend at Bernie's quality that you mentioned. But yeah, I can't say that I was 100% gripped and that my attention, you know, was on it 100% of the time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do know what you mean. I would say, though, we've got another very, very good child performance here. I did think that Aswan Reed, I believe he's called, who plays our eponymous new boy, was like really phenomenal.
Mm. So that's The New Boy, which is in cinemas from Friday. And there's now one more movie to round out this week's new releases. So this is Benel and Adama. Leila, could you set this one up for us, please?
I really like this one. So this is a directorial debut from Ramata Tulisi, who it came out in Cannes, which it seemed to like not get a huge amount of buzz from, but I think that's sadly the nature of Cannes. It's about this kind of pair of young adults. They're sort of in their 20s and they're living in this Senegalese village where kind of things are, you know, very conservative and there's very like set roles for like what each people of each gender do. Like Benel wants to basically just be out with Adama working on like building their home and like farming with him and hunting and stuff, but she's sort of constantly being forced to do the laundry. They're like desperately, desperately in love with each other and they have been their entire lives. But in this sort of culture of arranged marriages, she was actually made to marry his older brother. And the older brother has died. This is all before the film starts. I'm not spoiling. The older brother has tragically died. And as is kind of a custom in that thing, it's then quite acceptable and actually considered quite heroic for you to marry your brother's widow. So the two have kind of ended up happily married together, but only because of like quite tragic circumstances. Yeah, Adama is now sort of being pushed into the role that his older brother assumed of being like the kind of village chief and stuff, but they're just kind of not really interested in it. They want to go and have their like very individual little lives together. It's a bit, almost a bit like Terrence Malick's Badlands. Mm. Like they are like these perpetual outsiders in this very beautiful landscape. But yeah, crushing responsibility comes for us all, I suppose. And I'm making it sound like a much more subtle film than it is. It's actually like really funny and really, really dark. And there are like four great plot twists. It's not a sort of gentle romance at all. It's actually almost more of a very dark romantic comedy.
I haven't seen this one yet, unfortunately, but do you need to have that background? Obviously, you kind of explain what had been going on with the family beforehand. Kind of, is it one of those films that's helpful to go in with a bit of context, or is it kind of very accessible just to dive straight into it?
I mean, it's very accessible because I think she's quite clever with a lot of the time you have sort of like the Adama's mother or kind of like the sort of village elders or like, you know, kind of chieftains, all like giving them advice about what they're expected to do, which is a very handy way of like putting out some exposition and some like explanations. So literally people will like sit down and like debate what it is that they're doing and explain where their responsibilities lie and what is expected for them. So I think you need to know virtually nothing about Senegal in order to completely get what's happening in this. And yeah, the central character of Benel, who is, you know, it's Benel and Adama, but she's a little bit more of the lead. It's just such a remarkably dark, specific kind of feminist hero. It's, yeah, I absolutely love this one.
Were they largely non-professional actors as well? Is that right?
Believe so. I mean, it's kind of a classic thing that happens with like African cinema because there isn't like, you know, even though Senegal is actually one of the like best places in terms of African cinema, there isn't like a huge amount of like structure there. So a lot of the time when filmmakers are going in making films set there, they're having to kind of discover new talent. Io Capitano, which is out in not long from now, did a similar thing. Non-professional actors that are somehow the greatest actors imaginable.
And so what's the overall tone? Because you mentioned there's kind of twists and humour and things as well. Yeah, is there anything you could kind of compare it to? Or
strangely enough, it's kind of a bit Coen's Brothers-y.
Really? Okay.
You know, that like there are mysteries, there are like dark humor. It's also pretty graphic at times, okay. I would say. There's like, I mean, there is some kind of sexual stuff, but more if you're sensitive to animals being killed.
Okay.
Definitely not the one to you. And yeah, it's one hell of an ending. So, and under 90 minutes. So if you're a Coen's Brother fan, don't watch the Coen film, watch Vanilla and Adama instead.
And you recently spoke to the writer-director, didn't you, as well? Did you kind of learn anything interesting about the film through that?
Oh, yeah, she was absolutely wonderful. She's such an incredible, dynamic young woman. I think the cool thing about her is that, like, I think a lot of the time with, like, African cinema, there's a need to kind of be quite worthy. And some of it is, like, you know, great for that reason. Like, I love the films of Ousmane Sembène. Mati Diop's Dahomey sounds like it's going to be amazing. And, you know, Saint-Omer from Alice Diop, like, really fantastic films specifically coming out of Senegal. But, like, talking to her, she just wanted to have fun. Like, and it's not really trying to be a film that is about the great state of, like, post-colonial struggle. It's like, a much more, like, personal piece. And I think that that's a really cool direction for, like, a new young voice to be taking.
Absolutely. So if you like the sound of that, that is Vanelle and Adama, and that's in cinemas from Friday too. So as we're approaching the end of this episode, what would you say is your film of the week, Layla?
Oh, Vanelle and Adama, definitely. Yeah, kind of a mixed week. I mean, I wouldn't say that like any of these are like a complete waste of time, but yeah, that one is really something very special.
Ooh, and so with a massive caveat that I haven't seen it yet, I'm going to go for Monster. But I'll definitely be checking out Vanilla and Adama as well. And yeah, like you say, it's an interesting week. Maybe it's just this post-Oscars kind of vibe or whatever, but it's an interesting kind of not particularly mainstream week. We've got some sort of blockbusters ahead. June's obviously still doing gangbusters. So I guess we're in a bit of a lull between sort of, you know, those massive releases. So there's lots of interesting stuff out if you fancy checking it out. So yeah, so we're almost at the end of the podcast now, but if you want more Total Film Goodness, check out the new issue of the magazine, which is out now, or head over to gamesradar.com/totalfilm. And if you like the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question, which is a silly one. But Layla, do you have any early predictions for a film that might score big at the Oscars next year?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems a bit of a weird slate going forward because obviously we had like a massive pause with the strikes. So when I was kind of looking at like the most, you know, like anticipated films of 2024, a little bit slim pickings. I definitely think that so long as Studio Ghibli hasn't got like a secret film up its sleeve, Spider-Verse will definitely storm the animated section. Aside from that, Gladiator 2 doing well?
Yeah, that popped into my head as well. Are we definitely getting the new Spider-Verse this year? Or are we just hoping and praying that we do?
They promised it would come out, I think, like this week. They definitely said March 2024, which even at the time, I didn't seem terribly likely. But they keep insisting that it's coming.
I mean, with the cliffhanger, they can't keep us waiting. Like, I don't think you can keep your mate waiting more than a year, like when it's a cliffhanger.
No, but they're so secretive around that whole thing. I wonder whether they just like, even they were like keeping the cameos, they were keeping the cast away from us when like weeks beforehand. Yeah. When I did the feature for them, they were like working on it until I think like 3 days before it came out or something ridiculous. So even though it was like maybe the biggest team ever assembled for an animated feature, basically a small city was making this film. But yeah, I really, really hope that we get that this year. And maybe autumn, because that would be positioning it ideally for the Oscars. But one that I would love to see do well would be Nosferatu.
That was on my list as well.
Sorry.
I think I'm so excited about that film, really. Robert Eggers is another who just doesn't really seem to miss, does he? And I don't think he's been nominated or anything, has he? Or I don't think any of his films have thus far, have they, in any big categories at least, unless I'm completely unfairly
like
forgetting.
Shame.
Yeah. The Northman felt like had potential for that as well in terms of being his kind of biggest film to date and just being a bit more mainstream, I suppose, than is The Witch and The Lighthouse. So being more on the sort of Academy radar. But yeah, I reckon Nosferatu's got to be in for a chance. It just sounds so good. It's got that kind of classic film heritage. And yeah, he's just been making great films for so long. That'd be great. I just obviously I hope it turns out well, and so it would be great to see him acknowledged. Yeah, Gladiator 2, if that does still come out this year, people are going to be thinking about that because of how well the first one did at the Oscars. Again, it falls into that category where it's like a blockbuster, but feels kind of a bit different because, you know, we don't get so many of these sort of sword and sandals epics anymore. And, you know, it's a sort of a break from the usual franchise fare while still being, you know, just it's going to be just an enormous blockbuster, isn't it?
They did leak that Paul Mescal's going to fight some baboons. I really want to see that. Baboons are so scary.
I know, yeah. I mean, I wasn't the biggest fan of Napoleon, but just what Ridley did with the battle scenes there, can't wait to see what he's done with this new Gladiator. And I was also going to say just an obvious one in a way, but Dune Part 2 feels like a bit of an early front runner. Like, feels like it's sort of nailed on for like technical categories and VFX and things like that. You know, the kind of success of it all round and just how well people have responded to it will mean Denis Villeneuve maybe gets some acknowledgement there as well. Be interesting to see.
Yeah, that would be very worthy. I do wonder though with Dune, because it's obviously done so well, and I think Denis expressed that he wants yeah. to get Dune Messiah first and have it be as a trilogy. That might be a bit like with that Lord of the Rings thing, where because they know that there's the final one coming, and it's like that's the one that we're gonna give you.
I wonder if that happened a bit with Spider-Verse this year as well, where it's like, we don't know if Miyazaki's going to make another film, but we know there is another Spider-Verse coming, so we can have like the victory lap then once that one's out.
That would be very well deserved. That does seem a bit unfair though, to just like constantly be dangling like, this might be my last one. Didn't work for Scorsese, I suppose.
But yes, yeah, so check back in a year's time to see if any of our predictions have bared any fruit. But for now, that's all from us for this week. So thanks very much for listening. And until the next one, goodbye.
Bye.